From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Mariah Buxton is a nurse in St. Paul, Minnesota, a stable, service-oriented job that she's loved for 13 years. And then all of that changed.
I would say the middle of March is when everything kind of, is when things started to get scary. And then the beginning of April is when it started to look pretty ominous that we were not going to return to work as we knew it.
Mariah works in a post-operative unit at Children's Hospital of Minnesota. Many of those operations, like appendectomies, are considered elective procedures. And right now, almost all elective procedures and the revenue that comes with them have stopped. So one day early last week, Mariah and some of her colleagues were asked to come in a bit early before their shift started. She did. A hospital administrator announced that they would be mandating some nurses in her unit to stay home without pay.
It's kind of crazy because I remember, like, that was something people always, you know, once they heard I was a nurse, they're like, well, you're always going to have a job. So that's a great profession. And it's, you know, the pediatric world is just not as hit by this. And so, you know, it's just kind of my whole livelihood is damaged.
Mariah has joined the 22 million Americans who filed for unemployment. Even when she does go back, her hospital has implemented a 10% pay cut for the rest of the year.
It doesn't seem like I will be back to work anytime soon, and I don't know what it will even look like. The landscape of the hospital in general, just in our what our work will look like after this.
Of course, the terrible irony of all of this is that Mariah is a skilled healthcare worker who is out of work just when skilled healthcare workers are at the center of the largest public health emergency the world has seen in 100 years. Now, the public does recognize their importance. Applause echoes in cities around the world at 7 p.m. on many nights. But maybe we should also pause for a moment and consider why, in the United States, we have a system that results in thousands of doctors and nurses and other hospital workers being furloughed in the middle of a health catastrophe. On the surface, it just doesn't make any sense. But dig deeper and understand how American hospitals are run, and you'll find that it makes perfect, if tragic, sense. So this hour on Point, we're going to be taking a look at what the pandemic reveals about the business of running American hospitals. And we're going to start with Sae Nikpe. She joins us from Minneapolis, Minnesota. She's a professor of health policy at Vanderbilt University, and her research is focused on the impact of health reform on labor market decisions in hospital finance. She's also co-host of Trade-Offs, a podcast that explores the healthcare system. Professor Nikpe, welcome to On Point.
Meghna, I'm so happy to be here with you.
So first of all, you heard Mariah's story there. How common is it right now in hospitals?
Yeah, that is really a heart-wrenching story. My heart goes out to her. And, you know, we really have for a long time, just as Mariah said, thought of healthcare as just a bulletproof sector of the economy. And we are really seeing unprecedented job losses in that sector. These are really, really uncertain times for healthcare workers.
I think it's fair to say that we have literally never seen this many job losses this rapid in American healthcare. Is that right?
Oh, yes. I mean, I look at the unemployment numbers every day or every week, and they're just shocking. Unfortunately, we don't have very good numbers yet, specifically about healthcare jobs in, you know, this period of the pandemic that's kind of most that's most troubling, that's unfolding right now. The Bureau of Labor Statistics releases data with a little bit of a lag, but what we do know is that healthcare as a sector lost tens of thousands of jobs just in the first 2 weeks of March alone. And that that means that, you know, even when the pandemic wasn't really that hot, you know, hadn't picked up that much steam, we still had some job losses. And so I expect that that will accelerate quite a bit.
And those job losses are coming because of spectacular revenue losses in hospitals. I mean, the numbers are almost, they're so large, it's almost hard to believe, right? I'm seeing some hospitals reporting 50%, 60%, 70%, even 90% revenue losses in, what, the past month alone?
Yes. Yes. No, these are truly large revenue losses. And if you are a CEO of a hospital in the C-suite of a hospital, or, you know, we're not really going to talk about it today, I think, but, you know, in a primary care practice, for example, you are really scared right now. These are truly big hits to your balance sheet.
Well, so I'm just trying to like put some numbers out there to help people understand. And correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, Saya, okay? Because the CARES Act, I believe, put forth, what, $100 billion for the U.S. hospital system? But I'm seeing here that that might only equate to revenue losses for 1 month in the hospital system.
That is true. So $100 billion is a huge amount of stimulus. But, you know, hospital spending over a year at the national system-wide level is $1.2 trillion. So that really only ends up being about a month's worth of hospital expenditures. And now the thing that's more troubling, well, there's two things that are troubling, I find. One is that, you know, this is not just going to last a month. A lot of the projections are really talking about this lasting the entire summer, potentially into the fall, if we see a second spike, as we did with the 1918 flu pandemic. And, you know, this is, it likely will not be enough. The second factor that troubles me is that, you know, that $100 billion is really, you know, people are talking about it as being focused on hospitals, but really what the law lays out is that that money goes to healthcare providers who are affected by COVID. And so we have all these other providers like clinics, primary care practices that are outside of that hospital scope mm-hmm. that also potentially need those funds.
Yeah, no, that's a really important point to make. When we were trying to figure out sort of how to best talk about this issue this hour. Healthcare is so big, right? That almost 20% of GDP in the United States. We weren't sure if we could do a good job covering all sectors, so we're trying to keep the focus on hospitals. But your point about practices and clinics actually taking that first wave of hits is a really important one. Now, to hospitals, though. Okay, so let's raise our magnifying glass here. This has happened so quickly because of some fundamentals about how U.S. hospitals are run. Why? Where was all the revenue coming from to begin with pre-COVID-19?
Okay, so we have a primarily private market-based healthcare system where, you know, most Americans, about two-thirds of those who have insurance, are covered by private insurance companies. And what that means is that hospitals operate by, you know, negotiating rates with those insurers, and they keep the lights on by billing those insurers and patients at those negotiated rates. So the revenue that comes in has to, you know, support the hospital. So if we see that hospitals are starting to have to pull back on the services that they do for those patients, it's automatically going to mean that that source of revenue is going to fall. And what we're seeing from some hospitals anecdotally is that, you know, they're saying that some of the elective procedures that they've been doing account for anywhere between 50 to 80% of their revenue. So if you cancel those procedures and that's the main source of revenue for the hospital, that is a very, very quick way to lose a lot of your budget to cover your expenses.
It's practically the whole pie. But let's talk about what elective procedures mean, though, because I think the phrase is a little misleading. There are a lot of procedures out there that people might feel are not elective for their own health and well-being.
Yeah. And actually, it's really interesting. So different states have rolled out policies, and I don't know exactly where we're at right now. I'm imagining that almost every state has done this so far. They've done, you know, a state order to cancel elective procedures. Now, elective, as those state orders define it, is really not a hard and fast definition. There is no definition out there that says this is elective and this is not elective. But it's really up to providers to decide what is elective and what is not. Now, the American College of Surgeons came out with a statement very recently, kind of talking about, you know, canceling procedures that are not to save patients, you know, life and limb. That would suggest that really anything that is not to keep that patient alive is potentially elective.
So anything non-emergency care, non-urgent care, that's what we're talking about, which could be everything from, a joint replacement. They can do a lot of them very quickly in a hospital and make a lot of money. And maybe that's something you could wait for a little bit to, cancer treatments, which I'm sure people feel like they do not want to have to wait for that. It doesn't feel elective to them. But we're talking about the huge scope of services.
Yes. And it's the lines are not so clearly cut. So take something like placing breast implants. So I think a lot of people would say, oh, that is, a breast reconstruction surgery. That should absolutely be, an elective procedure. Well, if you're someone who's recovering from a double mastectomy and you're undergoing a procedure to regrow breast tissue, that actually may be something that needs to happen now and doesn't have that feel of a purely elective procedure.
So at the bottom line here, I think it's in every sector of the U.S. economy, and today we're focusing on hospitals, it's the rapidity of the shock, which is really like breathtaking here. And one would think that we shouldn't have seen that in the healthcare sector because it's core to surviving this shock for all of us. Is the problem that we have for decades now, have we been basically running hospitals like businesses?
Well, we have, because those are the incentives that hospitals face. Even public hospitals in the United States don't receive, their budget isn't fully from government, grants. Every single hospital in the United States, to keep its lights on, has to think about billing providers. And we are in a world that has kind of grown from several decades worth of kind of general trends and reimbursement changes, where people really have an incentive to kind of keep costs low and shift care out of the inpatient setting, which I think has implications for COVID.
Okay, so Sae Nik Pei, professor of health policy at Vanderbilt University and co-host of Trade-Offs, the podcast about the healthcare system. Hang on for just a moment. There's a lot more to dig into when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about the pandemic and the pitfalls of how hospitals are run in the United States, specifically how hospitals are run as a business and why we're seeing so many thousands of healthcare workers being furloughed right now in the midst of a public health crisis. And we're joined today by Sae Nik Pei. She's a professor of health policy at Vanderbilt University and co-host of Trade-Offs, a podcast that explores the healthcare system. And joining us now is Dr. Vivian Lee. She's president of Health Platforms of Verily Life Sciences, a digital healthcare company. She's also former CEO of the University of Utah Health, one of the largest employers in healthcare systems in the state of Utah. Dr. Lee, welcome to you.
Thanks. Great to be with you, Megan.
Okay, so first of all, you heard Sae describe the model, generally speaking, that many, if not all, U.S. hospitals have had to follow in the past several decades. I'm wondering, one phrase we haven't uttered yet is fee-for-service. So is that really what's at the heart here of how hospitals are run?
I think so. I think that we fundamentally are seeing through this COVID crisis that our healthcare system is failing this stress test, and it's because at its core, our healthcare system is driven by fee-for-service, or what I call in my book, paying for action instead of paying for outcomes or paying for better health. And as a result of the model, we are seeing that our hospitals are really, they're really living hand-to-mouth. And most health systems have very little in reserves. So as soon as they stop doing these procedures and stop carrying out these actions, They're forced to furlough employees, and it's really a tragedy.
Okay, so this is exactly why I think I'm going to ask this again and again, and forgive me both of you, because I just want to attack this from different angles. If hospitals are living hand to mouth because we're following a fee for service model, in other words, they don't get paid unless they do something. There's a big incentive to do stuff, and there's been thousands of articles written about how maybe there's a perverse incentive there. But B, in a time of crisis where they cannot do those things they usually get paid for, they don't get revenue. I mean, look, for other businesses, that makes sense. You don't provide a service, you shouldn't get paid. But hospitals are supposed to also be the safety net, right? They are one of the cores of the American healthcare system. How can we have a safety net that's supposed to also operate as a business? Aren't the two goals like kind of diametrically opposed?
Well, if our healthcare system and the whole healthcare economy were charged with maintaining the health of the population, if we were actually getting paid for better health outcomes, our system would not be designed to be reactive, but it would be proactive. It would be designed to be investing in prevention, in primary care, in public health, because we all know that it's much more cost-effective. It's so much more cost-effective to have a patient take their 10-cent a blood pressure pill, for example, than to come into our emergency rooms with strokes and heart attacks and so on. And so if we were paid, if the economic model was more around prevention and public health, our payment model could be very different. And there are some examples actually even within this country. So the VA and the military health system are both healthcare systems within this country who are paid on more of what we call a global budget, where they have essentially an annual amount that they're paid to keep their populations healthy. And so they're designed to incentivize, for example, in the military system, readiness of our military, which is what we want them to focus on. We don't want them to focus on procedures as possible to our soldiers. We want them to keep out of the hospital and to keep healthy and fit as possible. So there are lessons within our own borders that we could learn that would actually not only stabilize our system in terms of these times, these very trying times like now, and unexpected, as you pointed out, very quick, but also would put us in much better standing in terms of public health prevention and readying the country as a whole.
Professor Nikpay, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, well, so I am also a, you know, public policy person. And the thing that's been on my mind so much these days is that, you know, even with better payment models and a better, you know, buffer, right, from, you know, the revenue mix and these sorts of issues that hospitals are thinking about a fee-for-service world, you know, this is really where public policy is kind of necessary. Over the last four decades, there has been a trend towards reducing the number of inpatient hospital beds, and that's because a lot of services can now be done, thanks to advancements in medical technology, in the outpatient side, right? And I, as a patient, would prefer not to go to the inpatient side. I'd prefer to go to a clinic and have a procedure done in 2 hours. Well, that means that we just don't have as many hospital beds around. And that is a persistent problem that we are hearing over and over and over again from these hospitals as they try to ramp up capacity. We don't have enough beds. Well, you know, that problem is going to continue to sort of march on, and likely given the focus on, you know, value-based payments under the ACA, it's going to continue to march on in a direction of fewer beds. And so here's where I think public policy can really help to, you know, identify places where the market isn't going to provide the outcome that we want, and we have to do something else to get beds and supplies to people.
So Professor Nikpay, allow me to sort of argue the opposite point then here. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a historic moment that we are all collectively experiencing. Isn't there an argument to be made that having enough, maybe slack is not the right word, but slack in the system to account for the once in a century or once in two century events isn't really realistic, because it's not going to be the reality 99% of the time, even for the healthcare system, which is supposed to serve that core safety net role?
Yes, and I completely agree. And that's why I think there's a role for public policy, because these hospitals are responding to incentives that are placed in front of them, right? It doesn't make sense for them to keep a lot of hospital beds just sitting empty. Those beds are costly. And so here's a place where, you know, the federal government or state governments, you know, it would be great to be able to have them to be able to step in to kind of help these hospitals ramp up capacity.
Mm. Dr. Lee, so I mean, we keep talking about the incentives that are currently in place for hospitals. I would like to actually hear your firsthand experience running the University of Utah Health when you were CEO there. Just kind of on a day-to-day basis, how much was keeping costs low or trying to control costs at the center of how the hospital was run?
Yeah, that's a great question, Meghna, because for the most part across health systems, we are really incentivized economically by this fee-for-service model. We are incentivized to keep our intensive care units and our emergency rooms and our operating rooms as full as possible. And so most hospitals, you'll see if you look at their system dashboards for how they're driving, they're really focused on volume. They're focused on how many people can we get through as quickly as possible because we're mostly in a fee-for-service model. Now, increasingly, we've seen some changes. So when I was the CEO of the unit, two things happened that really changed our mindset. First, the state's Medicaid program in Utah, they would switch to a global budget. They would start paying us a fixed sum for each Medicaid patient that we cared for the year. Mm. And we had to keep them healthy and satisfied. Now, all of a sudden, the woman who last year had come into our emergency room 52 times, for whom we billed the state 52 different times, was now going to be our responsibility. So you can imagine how that incentive, that change in economic model completely switched our attention, pivoted us to thinking, how can we keep this patient healthy? We assigned her to a care manager. We made sure she had a primary care doc. If she had trouble getting transportation into that transportation, because we really wanted to keep her healthy. Now, of course, before we wanted to keep her healthy too, but the financial model was to make those investments necessarily.
Yeah.
So there were some pretty significant changes, which is why I feel so strongly that these incentives, changing the incentives, is really fundamental to changing our healthcare system.
You know, I've got to ask, when you say that the incentives currently in place in most places are, it's like a volume model, right? You were saying keeping emergency departments and operating rooms as full as possible to get as many people through there as possible. Crudely speaking, Dr. Lee, I mean, at a macro level, it makes a hospital system sound like not all that different from an airline, right? Because the airlines are incentivized to have as many passengers in the seats as possible, to cram as many of them onto an airplane as possible, and to keep that airplane flying. Ground time is not good for an airline. I mean, is that a fair analogy?
You know, I think it's a perfect analogy. And as you and Professor Nick Pei were saying earlier, you know, healthcare is a business. Right now in the US, it is a business. And I think the key is to recognize that as a business, its incentives are very much driven by the economics. And so if you take the exact same system, the system that was cranking forward and trying to do as many cases as possible at the University of Utah, when we were faced with Medicaid, when we were actually looking at Medicare, new models in Medicare as well, we decided to think about how could we starts for a new world where we were going to be paid for outcomes and we were not going to be winning in this fee-for-service model. And then all of a sudden, we paid very close attention to how we were spending our dollars and tracking patient outcomes. We realized prevention actually was going to save us money, was going to make us money in some of these new payment models. And we were able to change our system pretty dramatically in the areas where we were going to be paid differently.
Mm. And just to be clear for people who aren't familiar with this global payment model, as you've been talking about, in places where it's been launched, the idea is that per patient, a hospital or a healthcare system gets a bucket of money, essentially, and all the care for that patient has to be completed within that bucket of money. And the more healthy the patient is, the fewer services a hospital, say, University of Utah Health would have to provide, but you get to keep that money then.
That's right. It falls to your bottom line. So after I stepped down from being the CEO, I actually had a year sabbatical and wrote a book about healthcare, fixing healthcare, called The Long Fix, which is coming out next month. And as part of the research for that book, I studied some of these Medicare Advantage programs that are coming up around the country, including systems like ChenMed and Iora Health and CareMore. And these systems are taking Medicare dollars and contracting in a rather, I'd say, proactive way with the government to get paid in the same way to care for our frail elderly population. And they're getting a fixed amount of money to keep elderly patients healthy out of the hospital. They're investing a lot more in primary care. They spend 30 minutes to an hour with each patient instead of rushing through in 10 minutes. They provide transportation to the clinic. They really look carefully at their medications. And in the end, you know, Meghna, they save so much money on reducing hospitalizations that it nets very positive for everybody. It saves the government money and it saves them money. These are the kind of models we need to see more of in the country.
Okay, so Professor Nick Pala, these global payment models, as opposed to fee-for-service, they're not very widespread, are they?
No, they're not. And I think one of the reasons is that, you know, well, I think there's two reasons. One is that, you know, we have this mixed payer model. And so if you are a hospital and you wanted to do global payments, that's going to be global payments just for one particular sector of your patient population. For a typical hospital, there's about 20% who are Medicare, 10% who are Medicaid, you know, another chunk that are uninsured, and then the rest are, you know, in different private insurance models. And each one of those insurance models could have its insurance companies could have its own model of reimbursing you. And so there's, you could have global payments from all of them, but they would all be, you know, configured slightly differently. And the other issue, I think, that is really important right now is that setting that budget is difficult. Mm. And especially in a situation right now where we have exploding costs and they're really hard for managers to predict because we really don't know how this virus is going to unfold across the country. If that budget isn't enough, then what do you do? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of risk for hospitals when you, the good side, which is that it provides the right economic incentives, but there also is some risk if the costs end up being greater than the budget for reasons that are not your fault.
So, Professor Nick Pala, let me ask you, and I'll just be blunt about this. We're talking about a hospital finance or economic model that has been applied, the fee-for-service model, in both not-for-profit hospital systems and, this is America, we've got lots of large for-profit hospitals and hospital systems. I mean, does that not further exacerbate the problem?
Because it's in both, because we have for-profit hospitals?
Well, or the sort of the problem of how the hospital is run in for those that are for-profit.
Okay. So it's very interesting. The economics literature actually has quite a bit to say about this. And I think we kind of come down with the idea that not-for-profit and for-profit hospitals in a lot of ways are quite similar. Okay. They are both businesses. They are both trying to reduce costs subject to the revenue they get. And really one of the big differences is that, you know, for-profit can distribute its profits to shareholders. A nonprofit cannot do that. And in some ways, it's supposed to take those profits and distribute them to the community in the form of community benefits, charity care, things like that. But, you know, they both respond very similarly, I think, to these incentives provided by fee-for-service. There's not a ton of difference between, that's what the research tells us. There's not so much difference in the way that they respond.
I see. Okay. Well, that's interesting. Dr. Lee, we have about a minute before we have to take a break. This idea of really completely turning the hospital payment model on its head, which is fundamentally what we're talking about here, again, to be frank, it's been around for a while. What are the headwinds against global payments becoming more of how hospitals are run?
Well, you know, I'd love to talk about this even more after the break, okay. But I feel like one of the most change agents are our employers. So as Professor Nick Pala said earlier in the hour, our over half of Americans receive their health care through their employment. And this year, the one thing I think that we can see for certain is that healthcare costs and premiums are going to go up next year. So this is a time to really activate and engage those employers and help have them help drive some of this change. Right. It's in everyone's interest.
Well, we are talking about why we're seeing thousands of healthcare workers being either furloughed or suffering from pay cuts in the middle of a health emergency and what that says about how American hospitals are run. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be checking in with the cities of Miami, Houston, and Los Angeles about how the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting their cities, and especially the impact that it's having on Latino communities there. So if you're in Miami, Houston, or Los Angeles, or if you're a member of the Latino community, how has the COVID-19 pandemic had an effect on you and your community? How are things playing out where you are? Leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we're talking about the fact that thousands of healthcare workers, nurses, doctors are being furloughed or suffering pay cuts in the midst of a public health emergency that is the COVID-19 pandemic, and why that is and what that says about hospitals and how they're run in the United States. And I'm joined today by Saye Nikpay. She's a professor of health policy at Vanderbilt University and co-host of the Trade-Offs podcast. Dr. Vivian Lee also joins us. She's president of health platforms of Verily Life Sciences, a digital healthcare company, and also author of The Long Fix, Solving America's Healthcare Crisis with Strategies That Work for Everyone. That is a forthcoming book out next month. And joining us now is Marie Ritacco. She's a registered nurse in the post-anesthesia care unit at St. Vincent Hospital, which is operated by Tenet Healthcare, a for-profit company that operates some 65 hospitals across the United States. Marie, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So first of all, tell us a little bit about how you're feeling about your work right now, and if Tenet Healthcare has said anything about your job security or the future of your job as a nurse.
Well, our work right now is certainly very challenging. I think if any nurse told you that they weren't frightened, they would not be telling the truth. Of course, we're all frightened. We take our lives into our hands right now anytime we go into work, but that is not preventing us from wanting to be there. As you said, I work in the recovery room, and we take care of a lot of patients that are ICU level of care. So early on, we decided that we would work with management and essentially convert our Monday through Friday unit to a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week unit, which has been a huge challenge for 18 nurses to do. So as you can imagine, we need the assistance of other nurses in the facility that have the critical care skill set to be able to take care of those very critically ill patients in order to basically decompress the ICU. So it has been definitely a huge challenge for us, but one that we are ready to meet. However, our employer has decided that the nurses that are in the building that work in areas where our flow of patients is diminished, in those areas where we do elective procedures, like the operating room and the cath lab and the GI lab, same-day surgery, that those nurses, they decided, would be offered, I'd like to say coerced and bullied, into taking a furlough. And this has severely hampered our ability to be able to meet this challenge.
Mm. Well, we did reach out to Tenet Healthcare and to St. Vincent Hospital to see if they would have a comment here. And the best that we have right now is a video that was released last night where St. Vincent Hospital CEO Carolyn Jackson had a message for nurses. She delivered this message from an empty unit in the hospital in Worcester. And in the video, she says, we have had to close our or reduce our normal services to focus on the most pressing need, which is fighting this pandemic. It has changed the way our hospital operates, forcing us to make difficult decisions to ensure that we are putting our resources in the right places to care for patients who need us the most. And then she emphasized that the furlough program in Carolyn Jackson's words, is voluntary, and that some nurses have been retrained to support critical care. Marie, what do you think about that?
I think that she is sugarcoating the message that the hospital wants to send out right now. The message was very clear to nurses in the building. If you did not have the necessary critical care skills, their offer was to give you 4 hours of training. And they told us in no uncertain terms that they would be sending nurses to areas that they had never worked in before and expected them to take an independent assignment. And that was really just the turning point for nurses. It frightened them. You know, of course, nobody wants to go to an area that they have no experience in. But we have language in our contract that addresses a national issue such as this, or even a statewide emergency. And we know that nurses are willing to go to areas that they've never worked in before, as long as they would be considered helping hands. And that is needed now more than ever. Mm. But many nurses are choosing to take a furlough now because they're very frightened. And we have had to do a lot of work with our membership to let them know that in these critical care areas where we do need help, we're never going to let another nurse down. We are going to be there to basically guide the care that is given to patients. You know, in some instances, we're talking about patients who are literally dying alone with no family member at their bedside. We need nurses to provide hands-on care, holding someone's hand, talking them through this very devastating illness. You know, and you can't put a price tag on that. You can't put a price on someone's life.
Yeah. Well, Marie, last question for you is, as you've been hearing us discuss this hour, I mean, we're having this conversation because we're in the midst of this extraordinary event. And it's highlighted fragility in the system. Do you have any ideas on? Did you see that fragility before even COVID-19 arrived? And have you and your fellow nurses discussed, even at the level of where you're working in your hospital, things that could be changed?
Well, I mean, of course, it's always a struggle on a daily basis when you work in a for-profit institution. Their bottom line is profits. The bottom line of the nursing force in that building is to provide the safest, best care that we can. And now, as you know, we know this pandemic has certainly shined a light on the fact that the safety net is not there. They are not prepared to protect us. We don't even have the appropriate PPE, the protective equipment, to protect ourselves. You know, we're told that we have to reuse gowns, paper-thin plastic gowns that we have to reuse over and over again. So they're not prepared to protect us. We have to protect ourselves. We have to advocate for ourselves. And the community gets it. They understand this. In fact, today, several members of the community on their own decided that they wanted to support the nurses and the other caregivers at St. Vincent Hospital. And they're doing a drive-by protest of the hospital's practices with regard to bullying nurses into furloughs. We can do so much better for the people of our community. They deserve it. The hospital can afford to do it. The federal government has put in place a safety net for these facilities. They have the money that they need. Unfortunately, an employer as my own, Tenet Hospital, is just so focused on coming out ahead financially. They see an opportunity, and they're going to take it, and lives are going to be lost. And nurses are going to become ill at a very fast rate because the work process is so fast. And without the appropriate complement of staff, not only nurses, but PCAs and secretaries and respiratory therapists, you cannot stay safe in the workplace under this kind of stress. Right.
Well, Marie Ritacco is a registered nurse in the post-anesthesia care unit at St. Vincent Hospital, speaking to us from Worcester, Massachusetts. Marie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Magna. I appreciate the opportunity.
Professor Nick Pay, let me turn back to you because, you know, in Marie's case, she sees Tenet Healthcare is doing whatever it can in the midst of this crisis to get ahead. I take her point. We're also talking about various hospitals who may not be able to stay open through this. I'm just wondering that there's a variety of potential outcomes here. Are there some hospitals who simply will have to shutter their doors because they're losing so much revenue?
Yes, and thank you to Marie for her work. That really is a harrowing story. I mean, I really think that hospitals right now are a pretty varied group in terms of their ability to financially weather the storm of COVID-19. On one hand, you have these institutions that are big system-level hospitals that have a lot of resources, sophisticated managers such as Dr. Lee, who can really help to kind of make this institution provide as good of care as possible throughout this pandemic. But we have a lot of hospitals. There's about a quarter of hospitals that routinely operate at a loss in the U.S. We have hospitals who, just like we should have 3 to 6 months of our expenses in a savings account, there's a similar metric for hospitals. They're supposed to have cash reserves. For some hospitals, like those big system hospitals, those cash reserves are really nice and fat and can probably carry them through for a little while. But particularly for those independent hospitals and rural hospitals, cash reserves are very low. We have some anecdotal reports of hospitals talking about 3 weeks cash, 2 weeks cash, which is, if they're canceling all of their elective procedures, that's all they've got to pay their payroll and keep the lights on.
That's the hand-to-mouth that we were discussing
earlier. Yes.
I have to say, Dr. Lee, perhaps I shouldn't be, but it is a little shocking to hear that so many hospitals in America have basically no cash reserves. I mean, maybe if you're the Mayo Clinic, you're okay. But we're talking about hospitals in certain parts of the country that may be the only location that people can get health care. I mean, that also seems to be sort of a fundamental fragility in the system that they've been able to operate so long on margins that are so razor thin they don't have any money in the bank.
Absolutely. You couldn't be more right on that, Magna. And as Professor Nick Page just said, we have, just like we have vulnerable people in our society who are suffering so much, we have vulnerable components of our health system, like the rural hospitals, like the public hospitals. It's also worth pointing out our teaching and academic hospitals, how vulnerable they are and the consequences of that vulnerability, because we actually rely on, this is another odd aspect of our healthcare system that we really need to address. We rely on the profit from the clinical side of the healthcare business in our teaching hospitals to subsidize the teaching of our medical students, our nursing students, all of our trainees, as well as the research that we do. And so what we're hearing across all of the university hospitals across the country is a plaintive call for help, which is not only is this going to jeopardize our staff today, and my heart goes out to Marie and all of her colleagues and all the nurses across the country, all the healthcare workers that are suffering right now, but it also has long-term implications for the next generation, those that we're training and the research that they need to do. So this is something that we need to focus on. And when Marie was speaking, my heart was breaking because all of us who have been in health systems know that we are so dependent on our healthcare workers, and we're seeing them as heroes day in and day out. We in New York are cheering for them at 7 p.m. every night. We know that we are facing, in the steady state, we are facing a massive nursing shortage in the next few years. And so right now we're furloughing people because we're short on cash, but these are the very people that we need to help support our aging population. They're the people we need to take care of you and me and our parents and our families. And it's just another dimension of this dysfunctional system that we need to fix.
You know, at one point we haven't touched on, I mean, in the metaphor of hospitals being run as a business, is that many people would point out that just like in the corporate sector with C-suite level people getting paid ever more and more and more, we've seen that in hospital administration too. And I'm sure that rubs folks the wrong way when we're also then talking about those same hospitals having no money in the bank during a crisis. Now, Sae, Dr. Lee began talking about global payments, or really completely transforming the model of pay and incentives for the American hospital system. That is the big long-term goal, you know, turning the ship in that direction. It's going to take some time. What would you say would be an intermediate step to help get there? Because we also just have this crisis right now and hospitals struggling to keep their doors open.
Yes. So we need intermediate and even very short run policy solutions right now. One is, if you read the Inspector General's report from last month about what hospitals are needing, you know, we need hospitals to have some flexibility in regulations in the way that they can bill. So the Department of Health and Human Services, through the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, you know, has all sorts of rules for hospitals about, you know, you can bill for this type of a service in this type of a setting, or this type of worker can do this type of service, which is why deploying staff in a flexible way can be quite difficult. And so what we're starting to see is that CMS is relaxing some of those regulations, doing things like allowing primary care providers to do telehealth visits with new patients, for example, or doing things like boosting the reimbursements for telehealth so those primary care docs can get out there and talk to people so that they don't end up in the emergency room compounding that problem of just so much volume right now that's slamming the hospitals.
So we have, so those are good, like essential intermediate steps. Also, just like you said, more cash, like another stimulus round?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Dr. Lee, we've just got a minute left here, and I cannot help it. I have to ask you, I mean, you're president of health platforms at Verily. Do you have an update on Verily's COVID tracker?
Sure. So we have been at Verily working in response to this emergency declaration on a number of different fronts to try to help our communities manage through the crisis, including establishing some laboratory testing capabilities. As you know, that's been one of the biggest limitations, is our inability to just simply test the population. And we've also been building some tools for our hospital and health systems to help them tell and inform their communities about where they can get their care, assess their own risk of having COVID, and then getting access to the right phone number. And we're providing that free for health systems right now. So we're really trying to do what we can to help our communities.
Well, Dr. Vivian Lee, president of health platforms at Verily Life Sciences and author of The Long Fix. Dr. Lee, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Dr. Lee joined us via Skype. And Sae Nikpay, professor of health policy at Vanderbilt University and co-host of Trade-Offs. It was great to speak with you, Sae. Thank you so much.
I'm so happy to do it. Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.